Well, good day to everybody. My name is Martin Kinn, and it's my pleasure to host today's Weber Teleclass. I say good afternoon to those of you in the Americas, good evening to us in Europe, and it's almost good night to our today's presenter, who is presenting at the unearthly hour of 2:30 a.m. To us today. Our presenter today is Dr. Matthias Meiwald. He's a consultant in microbiology at the KK Women's and Children's Hospital in Singapore, and he's an adjunct associate professor at the Department of Microbiology in the National University of Singapore and at Duke NUS Graduate Medical School. Matthias attained his medical degree from the University of Heidelberg in Germany and subsequently worked at the University Department of Hygiene and Medical Microbiology. He then moved to the United States of America, where he worked as a research fellow at the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford University. Following that, he moved to Australia, where he worked as an associate professor and a consultant in microbiology at Flinders University School of Medicine and Flinders Medical Center in Adelaide, before moving to his current position in Singapore. He holds a German board certification in medical microbiology. He has a fellowship of the Royal College of Pathologists of Australasia, and is a diplomat of the American Board of Medical Microbiology. He has two main areas of interest. One is the molecular detection and characterization of fastidious emerging pathogens, and the other is infection control, with a special emphasis on hand hygiene and the prevention of surgical site infections. He is widely published on more than 100 occasions, including textbook chapters and original articles in peer-reviewed journals. And he today is going to be presenting on the subject of why evidence should have biological plausibility, the story of chlorhexidine and its role in skin antisepsis. Welcome, Matthias.
Thanks very much, Martin. Thanks very much, Paul. Dear colleagues, the title has been mentioned, why evidence should have biological plausibility, the story of chlorhexidine and its role in skin antisepsis. And I'll start by the next slide, slide two. And this shows two important people in the history of antisepsis. One is Ignaz Semmelweis, who lived from 1818 to 1865. And he implemented successfully hand antisepsis with chlorinated lime, which provides a killing of microorganisms on hands and is distinct from hand washing, which was already known at the time. The second is Joseph Lister, first Baron Lister, who implemented wound antisepsis and the spraying of phenol called carbolic acid in operating rooms. And this was not skin antisepsis, but it was a precursor of skin antisepsis at the time. Now let's move to the next slide. This shows two interesting papers in the history of skin antisepsis. One is a paper from 1903 by Charles Harrington and Harold Walker, The Germicidal Action of Alcohol, published in the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal, which is the predecessor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And from this paper, it can be seen that hand and skin antisepsis is already quite prevalent in the early 1900s. And on the right side, you see a paper published by Philip Price in 1939 that characterizes alcohol as a strongly germicidal substance, both in vitro and on the skin, within certain limits of concentration. And Price goes on to publish a number of seminal publications during the 1930s to the 1950s approximately. So let's go to the next slide. This slide shows you a brief history of antiseptic testing. And the first recorded test that I could find was in 1881 by Robert Koch, who published tests with Bacillus anthracis and alcohol. And this did not work well because, as we now know, Bacillus anthracis contains spores, and spores are not killed by common disinfectants, including alcohol. Then, in the 1890s, different authors tested various antiseptics for hand and skin. And in the 1930s to 1950s, the same author, as mentioned, Price in the U.S., published a number of seminal papers, and they provide precursors to the US FDA and ASTM test methodology. Then, during the 1950s to the 1970s, Lowbury and Lilly in the UK published seminal work on hand and skin antisepsis. And in 1958, Germany published its first national set of test methodology for testing disinfectants and antiseptics. Then, in the 1970s, the US FDA started publishing their tentative final monographs, which also contain information on antiseptic testing. Subsequently, from the 1970s to 1980s, different European countries created different national sets of test requirements for antiseptics, and from the 1990s onwards, national European test sets were unified in Europe-wide EN standards. Okay, next slide, please. We switch to something called evidence-based medicine, or EBM. Evidence-based medicine is a branch of medicine that makes conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of current best evidence in making decisions. And the measure is usually or commonly real clinical outcomes after different treatment. And there are different stages of evaluation. For example, there are clinical trials, and among the clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, or RCTs, are best. The next one are systematic reviews summarizing different trials. And then within the systematic reviews, one can do meta-analysis, which means that one calculates the outcomes of trials by mathematical formulas. And then the aim is to put this into so-called evidence-based clinical practice guidelines, which summarize and then publish the final recommendations on what to do in terms of clinical situations. Next slide, please. This slide shows you the process of evidence-based medicine, again, going from clinical trials, number one, to systematic reviews where different trials are summarized, to the next one, meta-analysis, where the outcomes of trials are subjected to what's called a quantitative synthesis. And then the next stage would be, through a formal evaluation process, an evidence-based clinical practice guideline. Next slide, please. So here we look at skin antisepsis and its modern relevance. And skin antisepsis is now a firmly established measure to prevent infections in healthcare. And it has a few main applications. One is before blood culture collection to prevent blood culture contamination. Another is before vascular catheter insertion to prevent catheter colonization and catheter-related bloodstream infection. And another is before surgery, also called surgical skin prep, to prevent surgical site infection. Plus, there are several more applications of skin antisepsis for various different purposes. Next slide, please. This slide shows you the antimicrobial spectrum and activity of skin antiseptics, and the information is taken from Larson's guideline on topical antimicrobial agents in 1988 and the CDC guideline for the prevention of surgical site infections published in 1999. And if you look to the left of the table, you see the three most common agents of skin antisepsis, which is alcohol, chlorhexidine, and iodine or iodophores. And if you look under rapidity of action, then you see the alcohols are most rapid in their action. Chlorhexidine has intermediate speed of action, and also iodine or iodophores have intermediate speed of action. However, if you look under residual activity, then you see that alcohol has no residual activity on skin, whereas chlorhexidine has excellent residual activity on skin, and iodine or iodophores have minimal residual activity on skin. And the CDC guideline states that alcohols are generally the most rapid-acting and most effective skin antiseptics, and according to published literature, the best activity is around 70 to 90% of concentration. And also according to published literature, the combination of alcohol plus chlorhexidine or iodine plus alcohol provides advantages. For example, there are added effects and added persistency, so it is better than the single substances. And it is important to know that alcohol is unsuitable for mucous membrane antisepsis because it is too strong for mucous membranes. Next slide, please. Chlorhexidine, among the skin antiseptics, featured in several prominent clinical studies. There is, first of all, the so-called Keystone Project in Michigan ICUs, published in 2006, and it describes a bundle of five evidence-based measures to decrease catheter-related bloodstream infections in ICUs. And as part of this bundle was mentioned chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis before catheter insertion and for maintenance. The other study here is chlorhexidine alcohol versus povidone iodine for surgical site antisepsis or surgical skin prep, also published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Another prominent study deals with preventing surgical site infections in nasal carriers of Staph aureus by chlorhexidine body washing. And I need to mention that the third paper is not on skin antisepsis in a strict sense. It is actually on antiseptic body washing, which is a different application. So next slide. In here, at some point, we noticed something unusual in the literature on skin antisepsis. So there was one blood culture study and two systematic reviews concerning surgical skin preparation. And all papers compared study outcomes from the combination of chlorhexidine plus alcohol, which is two active ingredients, versus povidone iodine alone, which is one active ingredient, and all concluded chlorhexidine is better than povidone iodine. Okay, we thought this was interesting. So next slide, please. What also happened is that chlorhexidine started to feature in practice recommendations and evidence-based guidelines. For example, a 2007 CLSI guideline on blood cultures recommended chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis. Then the 2002 CDC guideline and the 2009 draft of the 2011 guideline for catheters, intravascular catheters, recommended chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis, and the 2010 Australian National Infection Control Guidelines recommended chlorhexidine for surgical skin preparation. And there was a 2011 public call for revision of the UK NICE guidelines that suggested the possibility of chlorhexidine for surgical skin preparation. And there were numerous keynote presentations at conferences that also advocated chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis. Next slide, please. So we asked a number of questions. We asked the question, what is the factual evidence for chlorhexidine alone or chlorhexidine combinations in skin antisepsis? We also asked how common is the attribution of study outcomes from a combination of antiseptics to chlorhexidine alone. In other words, how common is it that authors assess results from a combination of antiseptics and actually conclude that chlorhexidine alone is responsible for study outcomes? And the third is, could this phenomenon have skewed evidence-based guidelines unjustly in favor of chlorhexidine? Next slide, please. So we embarked on a systematic review, and we did an exhaustive search for primary and secondary literature, which are clinical trials and systematic reviews. And we looked at chlorhexidine versus competitors in skin antisepsis for blood cultures, in intravascular catheter insertion, and in surgical skin preparation. And we looked at classical skin antisepsis and not antiseptic body washing or mucous membrane antisepsis, because they are totally, entirely different types of applications to classical skin antisepsis. And we used two criteria for literature assessment. One is whether the authors attributed study outcomes from a combination of alcohol plus chlorhexidine to chlorhexidine alone. And the second was, what was the factual or actual evidence for chlorhexidine that we could find? And we also did a non-exhaustive review of tertiary literature, meaning literature that cite clinical trials and systematic reviews and make recommendations. So next slide, please. We published our findings in this paper, which you can see here on this slide, in the journal called PLOS One. And the details of our paper are on this slide. And in the following slides, I will mostly talk about the results of this paper. So next slide is, here in this slide, we have a potential scheme of a clinical trial. So here's a clinical trial, and the trial has two trial arms. Trial arm A has two active ingredients, so active ingredient 1 and active ingredient 2, and they are used in a combination, and what follows is clinical outcome A. Then trial arm B has one active ingredient, let's call it active ingredient 3, and what follows is clinical outcome B. So next slide. And one of our criteria for assessment was whether there was an attribution of study outcomes from chlorhexidine plus alcohol to chlorhexidine alone. So, for example, articles concluding in this scheme, outcome A is caused by ingredient 1, or ingredient 1 is superior to ingredient 3, or the evidence supports ingredient 1. So next slide, please. This slide shows our blood culture studies that we included and assessed. And I should mention that this slide is very busy, very detailed, and I won't go into all these details, but what I would like to draw your attention to is the last column, which says attribution. So we ranked attribution as correct when authors recognized the antiseptic potential of alcohol and of chlorhexidine and attributed study outcomes to both active ingredients. We ranked attribution as incorrect when authors clearly attributed study outcomes from the combination to chlorhexidine alone. And we had an intermediate ranking which we applied when there was ambiguous attribution, for example, when authors recognized the antiseptic properties of alcohol but nevertheless had some wording or ambiguous conclusions that suggested that they thought chlorhexidine alone was responsible. And so for the blood culture studies here, we found 58% correct attributions, 8% intermediate, and 33% incorrect attributions. Next slide, please. This slide shows you meta-analysis that we did for blood cultures. The first meta-analysis on the top shows a comparison of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine alone. And what you need to be aware of is in a meta-analysis here, in this plot, the diamond-shaped thing, if it is on clearly on one side of the midline, then the outcome is significant. So in this particular case, the diamond shape is clearly on one side of the midline, which means in this case, chlorhexidine plus alcohol is significantly better than povidone iodine alone. The next meta-analysis below that shows a comparison of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus iodine tincture plus alcohol. And here you can see the difference is non-significant, so the two are not significantly different from each other. And the third comparison is coming only from one single study, so no meta-analysis done, but it shows no significant difference between chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine plus alcohol. So let's go to the next slide. To summarize our blood culture findings, we found no evidence for blood cultures that chlorhexidine alone is effective in preventing blood culture contamination. We found excellent evidence for chlorhexidine plus alcohol compared with aqueous povidone iodine. We found that the comparison of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus iodine tincture plus alcohol versus povidone iodine plus alcohol is either equivalent or unresolved. And according to one systematic review, alcohol alone for blood cultures may actually be sufficient. So next slide. We looked at some tertiary sources for blood cultures. And here on top, you see the CLSI blood culture guideline. And it says chlorhexidine gluconate, and it makes no reference to alcohols in that sentence, is the recommended skin disinfectant for older infants, children, and adults. Also, we saw a phlebotomy textbook that was effectively echoing the CLSI statements. And we saw statements on clinical microbiology discussion email groups advocating the benefits of chlorhexidine for the prevention of blood culture contamination. Next slide, please. This slide shows you the catheter studies that we assessed, and the slide, again, is very, very busy, and it's one part of two slides with catheter studies, so I'll switch to the next slide, please. This is catheter studies part two. Again, the slide is busy, but I will summarize. The attribution results are such that we found correct attribution in 35% of articles, intermediate attribution in another 35% of articles, and incorrect attribution in 29% of articles studying skin antiseptics for catheter insertion and maintenance. Next slide, please. Sorry. We performed some meta-analysis for catheters. This slide shows you meta-analysis for chlorhexidine alone, which is aqueous chlorhexidine, versus aqueous povidone iodine, or povidone iodine alone. And we analyzed two different outcomes. One is catheter colonization, and the other one is catheter-related bloodstream infection. And on top, in catheter colonization, you can see that aqueous chlorhexidine is significantly better than aqueous povidone iodine. However, in the bottom comparison, you see that the two are not significantly different in terms of preventing catheter-related bloodstream infection. So here, the difference does not reach statistical significance. Next slide, please. This slide shows you another set of meta-analyses, this time with chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine alone, or aqueous povidone iodine alone. So here you've got the comparison of two antiseptics versus one antiseptic alone. And the top meta-analysis shows you catheter colonization. Here's a significant difference. And the bottom analysis shows you catheter-related bloodstream infection. Again, a significant difference. So chlorhexidine plus alcohol is significantly better than povidone iodine alone in preventing both catheter colonization and catheter-related bloodstream infection. Next slide, please. So to summarize the catheter findings, we found excellent evidence for chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus aqueous povidone iodine. Also, aqueous chlorhexidine performs well against aqueous povidone iodine, but there was no statistical significance for catheter-related bloodstream infection, which is actually consistent with earlier meta-analyses. If you look into the earlier meta-analyses and look at the trials with aqueous povidone iodine, aqueous chlorhexidine versus aqueous povidone iodine, then our results are perfectly consistent with all earlier meta-analyses. Then we also found that the comparison of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine plus alcohol was unresolved. And we found, as a result, clearly better evidence in relative terms supporting the use of chlorhexidine plus alcohol than chlorhexidine alone. Next slide, please. So here we have some catheter tertiary sources. The first one is the already mentioned Keystone Project. It describes an intervention of five evidence-based procedures, and one of them is cleaning the skin with chlorhexidine, and alcohol is not mentioned. However, I inquired, and I found out that the participating hospitals in the Keystone Project actually use a chlorhexidine plus alcohol combination. Then we found the 2002 CDC catheter guideline plus the draft for the 2011 guideline, and both recommend use a 2% chlorhexidine preparation for skin antisepsis, and it was classified as evidence category 1A. Also, we found multiple websites, review articles, talks at conferences that stated the evidence supports chlorhexidine, and mostly there was no mention of alcohol. And then the CDC 2011 final guideline, after a public comment phase, recommended greater than 0.5% chlorhexidine preparation with alcohol. However, the CDC toolkit on the CDC website continues to recommend chlorhexidine with no mention of alcohol. Next slide, please. This slide shows you the surgical studies that we assessed. And again, the slide is very busy, so I will summarize. We found correct attribution in 36% of articles, intermediate in 21% of articles, and incorrect attribution in 43% of articles. Next slide, please. This slide shows you surgery meta-analysis, and the top one is a meta-analysis of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine alone, which is aqueous povidone iodine. And what you see here is a significant difference, meaning that for surgical skin preparation, chlorhexidine plus alcohol combination is significantly better than povidone iodine alone. We also attempted to look at chlorhexidine plus alcohol, how it would perform against iodine plus alcohol. And what we found that the studies using such combinations were very heterogeneous, had lots of lacking information, lots of information was absent from the trials, had design limitations, study design, and, for example, had alcohol concentrations far below the antimicrobially active range, and so we decided not to do an additional meta-analysis in that area. Next slide, please. Here is a summary for surgery. So for surgery, we found no evidence for chlorhexidine alone for superficial skin. And in fact, by way of background information, chlorhexidine alone, aqueous chlorhexidine, commonly fails the US FDA and ASTM regulatory requirements for preoperative skin preparation. We found excellent evidence supporting chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus aqueous povidone iodine. And the comparison of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine plus alcohol remains unresolved. Next slide, please. We looked at some tertiary sources for surgery, and on top is a current concepts review, and that states chlorhexidine gluconate is superior to povidone iodine for preoperative antisepsis. However, there is absolutely no basis for making such a statement. The next one is the SCOPE Surgical Care Initiative. And one of their checklist items is confirm that skin prep is with chlorhexidine unless contraindicated. And again, there is no basis for making such a recommendation. Another one is the Australian National Infection Control Guideline 2010, and it recommends chlorhexidine without making reference to alcohol, that it should preferably be used for skin preparation. And we saw several other websites stating that the evidence supports chlorhexidine, and mostly there is no mention of alcohol. Next slide, please. On this slide, we have some interim conclusions. We found altogether excellent evidence for chlorhexidine plus alcohol over aqueous povidone iodine in blood cultures, in catheters, and surgery, meaning all three studied applications. The comparison of chlorhexidine plus alcohol versus povidone iodine plus alcohol is inconclusive. And we found no evidence for chlorhexidine alone for blood cultures and for surgery. And we found moderate evidence that aqueous chlorhexidine works for catheters, but in relative terms, the evidence is of less quality than that for chlorhexidine plus alcohol. And it is becoming clear that the perceived efficacy of chlorhexidine is often based on evidence for the efficacy of the chlorhexidine-alcohol combination. What that means is people think there is evidence for chlorhexidine when, in fact, it is evidence for the chlorhexidine-alcohol combination. Next slide. What are the significance of the findings? First of all, the chlorhexidine misattribution is scientifically incorrect. Second, the phenomenon has quite sizable proportions. Third, it has led to unsubstantiated recommendations in clinical practice recommendations and evidence-based guidelines. Fourth, it is leading to a potentially mistaken a priori rejection of alternative or competitor antiseptics. And fifth, it has potential implications for patient safety, and I will elaborate on these points in the next couple of slides. And so I think that all this has broader implications for evidence-based medicine. Next slide. So this slide shows you the scientific relevance, and to recapitulate, if you have the arrangement with a trial where you have two active ingredients within the same trial arm in a fixed combination, it is not possible to conclude which of the active ingredients caused clinical outcome A. However, exactly that conclusion was made, in fact, in one-third to one-half of the evidence-based medicine literature on skin antisepsis, and it affected all levels of evidence assessments. So original clinical trials, systematic reviews and meta-analyses, clinical practice recommendations, and evidence-based guidelines. So all levels of evidence assessment were affected. Next slide. What are the proportions and impact size? It has sizable proportions. It affects blood cultures, vascular devices, and surgery, which are three areas of medicine. The rates of incorrect attribution ranks between 29% and 43%, plus additional ambiguous attributions. And in surgery, we found more incorrect than correct attribution. So the whole thing has a significant impact on how chlorhexidine is viewed in the infection control community. And another interesting aspect is that less than 30% of evaluated articles did both, which is correctly listed the active ingredients of the trialed antiseptics and correctly attributed outcomes to the actual antiseptic tested, which means one would normally think that it is a prerequisite for trial recording and trial publishing to actually do both of these aspects correctly. Next slide, please. It also has an impact on clinical guidelines. The phenomenon that we saw caused a skewing of systematic reviews of practice recommendations and evidence-based guidelines in favor of chlorhexidine. And that includes the US CLSI guideline, the CDC guideline, the Australian NHMRC guideline, and almost the UK NICE guideline. The new 2011 CDC catheter guideline received a correction, fortunately, I should say, during the public comment phase and is now correct. Also, we saw multiple recommendations for chlorhexidine alone at conferences, professional websites, etc. And I have already elaborated on these things in earlier slides. So we go to the next slide. The phenomenon also has an impact on alternative antiseptics. So there is a common rejection of alternative antiseptics on the basis that they do not contain chlorhexidine. And that is because the common perception of efficacy is pegged to chlorhexidine, not to alcohol. And it works by negative implication. And so people argue it does not contain chlorhexidine and therefore it is not supported by evidence. And there are multiple examples of such published articles. Next slide. It also has patient safety aspects, and the patient safety aspects come from the fact that there are multiple recommendations to use chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis. And what may happen, what is a possibility, is that caregivers may take these recommendations literally and use aqueous chlorhexidine, meaning chlorhexidine alone for these purposes. And what this would mean is they would use an antiseptic which is not supported by evidence, which we have discussed in the previous slides. For blood cultures, I think there is no direct threat to patients, but an indirect impact from contaminated blood cultures. For catheters, it may have a minor impact because we have seen that aqueous chlorhexidine has some protective effect in terms of catheters. However, for surgery, there is no evidence that chlorhexidine alone is effective, and several studies have actually shown significantly different surgical site infection rates between different antiseptics, and that's where this may have an impact because people would be using an antiseptic that puts patients at risk. And conversely, on the other side, if caregivers are unaware of the presence of alcohol in skin antiseptics, they may use accidentally alcohol-containing antiseptics on mucous membranes where they are contraindicated. And so this has a potential impact on patient safety. Next slides. We thought about what were the possible origins of the chlorhexidine misattribution. And I must say quite clearly, the issue is unclear to me. We could not find a clear cause, and so it is a matter of speculation. First, we think that the alcohol may be viewed as a carrier substance or a solvent for chlorhexidine because there is a common view of chlorhexidine in alcohol, and I have also seen statements describing alcohol as a solution base for chlorhexidine. Also, alcohol may not be universally viewed as an effective antiseptic. For example, the CLSI blood culture guideline views it as a cleansing agent at the venipuncture site. Also, the word chlorhexidine may be used actually for the chlorhexidine plus alcohol combination. However, this would be clearly medically and scientifically incorrect. Next slide. We switch to a slightly different topic. This slide shows you the principles of antiseptic testing. So there are two major test principles of microbiological antiseptic testing. One is called suspension tests, and the other is called tests under practical conditions. Suspension tests are usually tests in a reagent tube format, and they can be qualitative or quantitative. And as you see on the right side of the slide, what happens is you mix a bacterial suspension with a disinfectant solution, and after certain contact times, you add a broth with a neutralizer or inactivator that inactivates the disinfectant action, and then you look how many bacteria are still alive after disinfectant action. And the second type of test are tests under practical condition, for example, tests on real hands and on skin, etc., etc. And for other types of disinfectants, you may have tests for surface disinfection under practical conditions, etc. And for most of these tests, there are also test standards or test protocols published. Next slide. This slide shows you antiseptic testing standards. And there are two major types of standards, the U.S. standards, and those methods for skin antiseptics are described in the FDA tentative final monograph in 1994. And corresponding methods, equivalent methods, are published by the ASTM, which is the American Society for Testing and Materials. And examples are an ASTM suspension test and an ASTM test on skin for which protocols exist. And the second are the European standards. Europe has the problem that it has many countries, and it used to have many national protocols, and they have become partly unified, but not all unified in EN standards. And so as examples, there is an EN suspension test that's been standardized, but tests on skin, for example, still follow national test protocols. Next slide, please. Here, I'm asking the question, what are the benefits and limitations of microbiological testing of antiseptics versus clinical trials of antiseptics? And this slide deals with microbiological testing. And microbiological testing does not measure real clinical endpoints, meaning it is a surrogate marker, and clinical outcomes may differ from the test results. However, in antiseptic history, the results have been shown to predict outcomes reasonably well with minor inconsistencies. On the positive side of microbiological testing, there is no risk for patients from real infections. And the testing can be very detailed. Many different compounds can be tested under different conditions, and again, don't put patients at harm. And manufacturers can tweak and optimize antiseptic composition according to test results, which means that manufacturers can make antiseptics of different compositions, vary the composition, and then optimize all that according to performance in microbiological test results, which is quite an effective way of doing things. Next slide, please. Here we deal with clinical trials. Clinical trials provide information on real clinical outcomes. These trials can be analyzed in systematic reviews, as we have discussed, and in meta-analysis, as we have discussed. And overall, because it measures real clinical outcomes, clinical trials provide the strongest evidence to support clinical decisions. So in the evidence strength, they are much better and much stronger than microbiological testing. However, clinical trials are limited by the numbers of agents that can be compared, and each individual test requires hundreds, perhaps thousands, of real patients to be tested. And there is a risk from real infections. For example, surgical site infections can be serious complications. So if you think, for example, of an infection after open heart surgery, for example, a mediastinitis, this is a very serious life-threatening infection. And so I would like to pose an open question. Is it ethical to go into a trial when there is about a 10-to-1 microbiological difference between antiseptics? And this actually applies to some of the published trials, where I, as a microbiologist, looked at the compounds that were tested, and I, as a microbiologist, could say, look here, I can see there is, on microbiological grounds, a significant difference between the two, already before the trial has been done. Next slide, please. This slide shows you some more aspects of microbiological performance of antiseptics. So this is from a famous figure from Rotter, from a book chapter on hand washing and hand disinfection. And this is a figure on surgical hand antisepsis. What you see here is, if you look at the top left side of the figure, is the p-values before antisepsis. And if you go down and look after disinfection, you have time point 0, which is immediately after disinfection, and you have time point 180 minutes after disinfection, which shows you any persistent activity of the antiseptics. And what you see is, if you compare povidone iodine, chlorhexidine, and the various alcohols like isopropanol and n-propanol, you can see that the alcohols have significantly better immediate activity than either chlorhexidine aqueous or povidone iodine aqueous, and that's by about a factor of 10, meaning we have approximately a tenfold or more difference between alcohols and the other agents. Also, if you look to the lower left side of the figure, and sorry, the arrow there is accidentally inverted, it should be pointing towards the little point. If you look towards this end of the figure, you see that the combined activity of chlorhexidine and isopropanol in terms of immediate activity at time point 0 is approximately the same as isopropanol alone. However, where they differ is at 180 minutes, the other arrow, sorry for the inverted arrow, where you can see that the addition of chlorhexidine adds persistent activity, whereas with isopropanol alone, you already see rising bacterial counts after 180 minutes, so there is no persistency here. Next slide, please. This is another test of skin antiseptics in combination. And what you see is two different compounds compared. One in the red one is a combination of povidone iodine plus alcohol plus isopropanol. And the other one is a combination of chlorhexidine plus alcohol, the green one. And what you see is the values below baseline. And you see that povidone iodine plus alcohol is better at baseline than chlorhexidine alcohol, but at later time points, chlorhexidine alcohol catches up and has quite good persistent activity. And so these microbial data on skin indicate that povidone iodine plus alcohol has some additive or synergistic activity, whereas chlorhexidine plus alcohol has greater persistency. Next slide. This slide shows you some of the biological and functional requirements for skin antisepsis. So we start with blood culture collection. So blood culture collection has a requirement, a functional requirement for immediate kill of microorganisms. And there are about 2 minutes you take the blood culture, and after that there is no requirement for persistency. Next one is surgical skin preparation. There is a requirement for immediate action. And then another requirement for persistent activity for hours under the surgical drapes. And the third one is vascular catheter insertion and maintenance. And if you look here, you have a requirement of reducing the microbial counts before catheter insertion. However, because catheters stay in place for days or even weeks, there is also a big requirement for persistent activity during these days and at maintenance intervals, for which you also do skin antisepsis. So what it means from a functional perspective and also from a biological plausibility perspective, the relative importance of chlorhexidine increases with increasing requirements for persistency in this model. And conversely, the relative importance of alcohols in the mix will decrease with increasing requirements for persistency. And if you look back at the clinical trials and meta-analyses that I showed you in the earlier slides, you will see that the microbiological properties plus the biological and functional requirements are actually quite consistent with the outcomes that we described from the actual clinical trial. So the two are actually not very different in those points where data exist. Next slide, please. This slide shows you that the microbiological efficacy of chlorhexidine also is sometimes overestimated. And you see three papers, so one letter to the editor and two full-scale papers. And this slide explains you that some antiseptics, and that's particularly true for chlorhexidine, continue to act antimicrobially after sampling. And so what has to happen is one has to add neutralizer agents to stop the activity of the disinfectant during the sampling process. And this is mandated by various testing standards. And there are actually some studies, including clinical trials, that are published without data, without neutralizers. And that includes clinical trials which assess skin antiseptic counts, microbial counts after skin antisepsis in these trials. Next slide, please. So I think our findings have implications for evidence-based medicine. And that is because the attribution problem affected systematic reviews and strict evidence-based guidelines. And by way of background information, the evidence-based process is a very highly structured process and has to go according to a relatively rigid protocol. But nevertheless, it was affected by the attribution problem. And we need to ask the questions, what are the reasons for this and what are further implications? First, I think there may be a component of subjective views held by authors. Some authors may have simply assumed alcohol is a solvent. And as a second aspect, it highlights the principle of biological plausibility. And if you look at the properties of the antiseptics, you have a combination of antiseptics where one is significantly stronger in immediate activity and the other significantly weaker. And it is just simply biologically implausible that study outcomes from such a combination would be solely due to the weaker antiseptic, but absolutely not to the stronger antiseptic that's used in the combination. This is just implausible. And biological plausibility is a requirement in epidemiological research as part of the so-called Bradford-Hill criteria, but there is no current requirement for biological plausibility in evidence-based medicine. So the Cochrane Handbook, which has a relatively detailed set of instructions, very structured, very detailed on how to do evidence assessments, has no requirement for biological plausibility. Next slide. This slide shows you the famous Bradford Hill criteria and a picture of Sir Austin Bradford Hill, who was a British epidemiologist. And in his famous criteria, he published plausibility as a criterion, but he also stated quite clearly that this cannot be universally applied because it depends on the medical knowledge available at the time. But in other words, and this is a modern interpretation, the cause and effect relationship should be biologically plausible and it must not violate the known laws of science and biology. So we go to the next slide. Here are some relevant implications for patient care. And I would say sometimes it pays to look behind the scenes of what exactly published evidence is based upon. The other important aspect is that alcohol is a powerful antiseptic, and the chlorhexidine plus alcohol or povidone iodine plus alcohol combinations have benefits from the combination of two active ingredients. Chlorhexidine, when used on its own, may not be the actual antiseptic supported by evidence. And the other aspect is it is important to be aware whether or not an antiseptic contains alcohol, because in clinical practice, in patient care, it is then contraindicated for mucous membranes. And the jury is still out whether chlorhexidine plus alcohol or povidone iodine plus alcohol is better for some of the applications. So we go to the next slide. These are the conclusions. I would say a significant medical literature error has occurred in the area of skin antisepsis. And a likely reason for that is that published non-evidence-based medicine information was not looked at or not taken into account. Authors did not check whether new conclusions were consistent with the principles of biological plausibility. And from this instance, it is clear, at least it is clear to me, that biological plausibility should be taken into account in evidence-based medicine assessment. Also, on a different note, I would also like to put forward that it is not sufficient to look at antiseptics only from either a clinical trial point of view or from a microbiological testing point of view. It is actually useful if one can see antiseptics under both aspects, meaning the microbiological testing aspects plus the clinical trial aspects, because both aspects together provide a combined picture. I would like to conclude by saying that, unfortunately, it is unclear to me exactly how a plausibility check can be incorporated as a formal evidence requirement. However, that is something that at this point in time I would like to put forward to the scientific community. Perhaps you, the colleagues, and the scientific community as a whole has ideas how something like that can be achieved. And at that point, I would like to close. I would like to show the next slide with the acknowledgements, and I would like to thank everyone for listening and for your attention. Thank you very much.
Bas, thank you for that tremendously comprehensive and very thought-provoking presentation. There is an email address for both Matthias and myself at the front of the presentation. If anybody has any questions, you may either email Matthias direct, or if you send them to me, I'd be very happy to forward them on. Again, thank you so much for such an interesting and thought-provoking presentation. And thank you to Paul Weber for facilitating yet another excellent teleclass. I look forward to speaking to you all sometime again in the future. Good day to you all.